begin. So, I think this is class 9 of our series of this book, The Intimate Way of Zen by James Ishmael Ford. And let's see. I always forget to do this ahead of time, but let me pull up the Oxfording pictures so we can see what Oxfording picture we are talking about. The assignment, if you will, chapters of this book, there were four chapters. The chapters aren't very long, and I'm not going to have a chance to talk about all four of those chapters, but that's kind of how the class series broke down. So let me share my screen so we can review briefly. So these are the 10 Oxfording pictures, which were created in China to describe the spiritual path, starting with searching for the ox being enlightenment, awakening, truth, the mystery, whatever it is that we are searching for. Searching for the ox, finding the footprints, finally glimpsing the ox, catching the ox, taming the ox, and then the chapters that we're studying tonight are from the sixth picture, Riding Home on the Ox. So we'll get to the other ones later. The spiritual path doesn't even end here. But in this sense, now we have come into relationship with the mystery and have us we don't even have to have it on a rope anymore, right? It is part of our life. So I'm going to first talk about chapter 20, which he calls Magic Lands, because he talks about some stuff in here that I think it's important for us. I don't want to spend too much time on it because there's many other great parts of these chapters. But it's an important thing to periodically mention in a Zen or Buddhist community. So he's saying, the neuroscientist and longtime Zen practitioner James Austin notes that, quote, intensive meditative concentration for weeks or months invariably yields visual or auditory aberrations, hallucinations, or unusual somatic experiences. I personally think that's a very extreme statement. Invariably, that's not been my experience. It may on occasion. So basically, it's about these kinds of unusual experiences, which Ford talks about disruptive meditation experiences. He says there's the Japanese word makyo. For instance, points in this direction. It consists of two characters, the first of which can mean demon or magic, while the second can be read as place, boundary, or condition. The colloquial rendition I've heard most for Makyo, or heard for Makyo, is demonic interference, or demon cave, or ghost cave, and perhaps my favorite rendition, magic land. So he says, let's look at the first intimations, the earliest. So, this is on page 169, if you tend to like to look along. The earliest strata of Makyo. At the beginning of our practice life, mostly these are small things, physical or perceptual distortions that come across as experiences with little intrinsic meaning. I've seen things when facing a wall or gazing downward at the floor in Zazen. Early on, the strangest of my persisting physical makyo was listing strongly to one side while feeling I was sitting upright. The monitor would correct my posture, gently pushing me back upright, and I would feel sure I was being pushed into an angle. These experiences have no particular meaning. They don't convey secret messages. But they do tell us that how we sense the world is governed by many things. Only some of them, the objective world itself. Objectivity itself begins to get slippery. And noticing the slipperiness is foundational, at least so long as we don't impute deep meaning beyond that realization about our senses and the information they convey. Makyo can take on much larger contours as well. It is not uncommon for practitioners to have full-blown visions. These can be at the edge of consciousness, similar to a waking dream, where one can experience it while being aware it is a mental state. I, this is James, had a visionary experience of my own. It happened during a Zen meditation retreat, but not on the pillow. Sitting in a chair in the rest area, I had a vision of Jesus walking toward me, his hands together palm to palm, like the Christian prayer mudra, or the Hindu namaste or Zen's gassho. He was saying, "I have a great gift for you." My immediate thought was of my childhood Jesus, the one with all the little children, and I felt waves of love washing over me. Then he spread his hands to reveal those infamous bleeding wounds. A terrible visceral fear leapt into my throat as he then grasped my own hands with those bleeding hands. And with that, the pain of worlds birthing and dying ran from his wounds into what are now mine. And then it was over. I was back at the retreat. The physical residue was that my hands hurt for weeks. To this day, I can still sense an echo of that hurt. For me, within the Makyo aspects, there was an intimate encounter. As it happened, it was a meeting of the world and the great empty. That reality of form and emptiness is experienced in a lot of ways. In that moment, as a crucifixion. The experience departed from the relatively cold-blooded formulation, form is emptiness, and took me into suffering and joy and. But in that moment, I took the guidance of my teachers and simply let the experience happen and also let it go. Then it could do whatever work needed doing within the dark places of my heart, and that touch has continued its unfolding. So, like I said, it's worth talking about these things because sometimes they happen to people. I knew a guy who often smelled dog poop when he sat. I mean, that's kind of an unfortunate makyo, but there it is. You know, sometimes it is kind of involuntary physical sensations or movements. Sometimes it's a, you know. I rarely have these kinds of things, but maybe sometimes it's just kind of like a semi-hallucination, translucent hallucination, right? That you can see stuff through. You know, so ranges from that to this kind of dramatic thing that he's talking about. And it's tricky when you talk about these kinds of things because how are we supposed to relate to them, right? If somebody has those kinds of experiences, does that mean like their practice is really deep? They're meditating really deeply. They like there's something right about their practice. If you don't have them, is something wrong about your practice? If you have these visions or sensations, is something wrong? Like, you know, what, I guess, you know, my advice, which is basically just like Ford's and just like his teachers, is he talks about this later in the chapter, just not denying these things, not worrying about them. If they have any kind of deeper import, to allow that to unfold, but not be, I guess, not have an agenda about them, not being attached to them. Because they can be distracting if we think like, oh wow, you know, that must mean that I'm meditating really deeply, that I had this phenomenon happen. So he ends the chapter by saying, if you're seeking the wise heart, accept the disruption of what you might ordinarily consider real, and don't chase after these disruptions. Rather, let them come to you as they will. Be present, and when they come, hold them lightly, sincerely, passionately even, but don't squeeze the life out of your encounters. Hold them with open hands, like a master rider would hold the reins of their ox. And then the other big danger, we talk about this kind of thing, is comparison, right? Comparison with other people we know, or wondering how we measure up. And that's just right. It's just so fruitless. I mean, just saying that though, like, doesn't mean we're not going to do it, right? It's human nature. It's human nature to wonder, I don't know, how does my experience compare? And if we have friends in the Dharma, and they might experience, say what their experience is, and your experience is very different. I mean, like, many of you have heard me say, like, it's been difficult for me to concentrate in the classic sense. I've not had too many, like, far out transcendent experiences, or they were hard won, right? Like, I had to sit half a session in order to feel like that. And so for a long time, I could wonder, am I just not getting it? I'm just not, there's other folks who are concentrating, and they're not having difficulty with that attempt. But all I can say is, like, I don't know. This is a wide and messy path. And ultimately, it really, as long as we are engaging the Dharma wholeheartedly, and we are sitting our best, it just can look so vastly different for different people. And accepting our karma, fully inhabiting and accepting the life that we have, the brain that we have, the body that we have, the karma that we have, that's what it's really about. So, before I go on to something else, any questions or comments about magic lands? If you have these kinds of experiences, you're very welcome to talk to me about them. I don't think we have to dismiss them as unimportant. Like you said, some of those kind of physical ones are generally not significant, but sometimes these are. And he was great in this chapter, because he said, what can this be, a significant insight or what? And he's been like, it's a it's kind of a spectrum, perhaps. Percy.
I have a question. I hope you
Yeah.
don't take this wrong with that. I'd never heard of this before, but it's really interesting because for some reason,
You come out and sit
so
in the
my thinking goes to how this is similar to a mushroom trip, in the sense that it like causes you to see the unseen almost. And there's so much evidence and research that meditation is helpful, for us psychologically to overcome, many things, right, that we are challenged by. And now there's research similarly with these compounds that may help us the same way. There's so much overlap there.
Yeah, I think, like Ford was saying, this the kind of the value, if you will, of any of these experiences is that they open our minds a little bit about our perception of reality. Even if, in a sense, we know this thing isn't real or whatever, but we're kind of experiencing it, right? So it, yeah, it changes the same way maybe psychedelics can, of just, the world isn't what you think. Like, your mind is not as rigid a thing as you think. The good thing is that we don't these we don't have to have kind of remarkable experiences on the meditation seat or off to start getting that message, right? Like, just sitting and, perhaps being in the midst of anxiety and sitting and watching that anxiety ebb just because we just sat, not because we figured anything out or solved anything, right? That's like, just my mind, the mind's narrative about its own reality gets shaken up a little bit. Good point. Betty.
Thank you. I have cryptic notes that I can't actually make sense of now. But some stuff comes to mind in that, that I'm sort of a lot more attuned to my somatic experience than sort of other stuff. So, I wonder how much of the somatic experience is part of this Makkyo manifestation. So that'll be sort of interesting to think about. But I like the term magic lands, but I'm curious about the terminology around demonic interference, because that seems like it's sort of attached to negative judgment about this experience. So can you talk, did I miss that? Can you talk about that for a sec? That terminology and where that came from?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if the Japanese term, like, within their cultural context, has a negative term the same way we do. Demonic sounds pretty, which they have like spirits and stuff like that, right? The kind of the demonic part comes in just in my framing of practice and what I've been taught is really it. If we get attached to it, if we get confused and attached to it, and we go like, oh, I want to have more of that, or I must be, on the path of enlightenment if I can, like, I don't know, people can do, certain people who can concentrate really deeply can like do weird stuff to their brain while they sit there. Not permanent, not like damage, but like, you can go into states where it's like what Kyogen described. He had meditated so intently at the monastery that for a period of a couple days he lost all of vision on one side of his, like out of one half of his field of vision. So you can do stuff to yourself if you are really striving to make something happen, to break through, to, I don't know.
Got it. That makes sense, like an attachment to it.
Yeah.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
Max.
I find this stuff pretty interesting. It did draw me to meditating, supernatural experiences. I'm kind of like an adrenaline junkie, especially growing up. I was just always excited about all these cool, novel experiences. And I found myself like kind of craving them and like almost sitting down and pursuing them. And I kind of felt like that it, I didn't get the same wholesome results out of meditation if I sat down for those reasons. Or, yeah. And so you kind of said to not pursue them, but maybe open to them. Is that kind of,
Yeah,
I
because
mean,
I mean,
is
on the
that what
other
you
hand, you
recommend?
could be like, I'm gonna sit and make sure those things don't happen, right? Like, you. There could be a kind of rigidity about it as well. If you were like scared of them or trying not to be attached to them, like, is it gonna happen? I better not. I'm gonna, yeah,
Yeah.
it's more of a Yeah, not trying, just like anything else, right? In our zazen, just not trying to push it away, not trying to make it happen. If something weird's gonna happen, it's gonna happen.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. Thank you.
but it is generally, this is, I mean, I'm not an expert on this kind of stuff, right? Like Chinese medicine and yoga and that kind of stuff. But in general, if you are having kind of weird experiences in your meditation, try to move the energy from here down into your hara, which is the kind of space in your belly below your navel. Generally speaking, like it's, I mean, that maybe not always, but it's often like kind of a bearing down energetically in that space instead of being more centered in the body. So if you bring it down in your body and you kind of, do deep breathing and stuff, it's much less likely that you're gonna go off into some kind of wacky magic land. You have something? Okay. All right. Well, let us, and again, like I said, you can always talk about it if something comes up. Okay. So in chapter 19 is the distant song. And so he tells the story of Demeter, Persephone, and Hermes. And I'm kind of only saying this because then the part that I'm going to read references it. But Demeter, am I pronouncing that right? Yeah. The goddess of the harvest. And her daughter is Persephone, who was kidnapped by Hades, the god of the underworld. Demeter, not knowing what has happened to her daughter, is overcome with grief, which causes the earth to go barren, endangering all life on the planet. And Demeter wanders the stricken world seeking her daughter until she learns that Hades has kidnapped Persephone and made her his queen. Through the intervention of Zeus, the messenger Hermes is sent to reclaim Persephone. So he refers to that as kind of a, if we see the gods as being part of ourselves and kind of like a mythological spiritual story. So I thought this was just a really sweet page. This is 166. So I'm kind of speaking, I guess Demeter is, searching for her lost daughter and in despair. Perhaps your heart has broken. Not quite doing what you dreamed you would, suffering abandonment of one sort or another, experiencing illness or the impending death of yourself or someone you love, experiencing death itself. The list of hurt is long. Of course, you know what your hurt is. When we find this sadness in ourselves, there tend to be two responses. One is to be filled with the sorrow, to be lost in the sorrow, to drown in the sorrow. We have wounds, and the temptation is to poke them and probe them endlessly, preventing any healing. And in truth, poked or not, some wounds never do heal. But even then, it just doesn't help to constantly jab a stick into it. And yet we do. But there is something else that sometimes happens when we pay attention and are just a little lucky. Through the mediation of the Hermes of our hearts, the trickster who joins all things, we find the sorrow is part of something larger. Winged Hermes connects it all, and we find ourselves in the midst of sadness, surrounded by joy. We find our hurt and our joy sit together as old friends. We find a larger world, a world that shuts nothing out, but rather encompasses it all. Hurt, longing, the quest, finding, joy, and even death itself are one thing. And like becoming one with the quest, this knowing too is enough. I thought that was a beautiful paragraph. In the midst of our sadness, surprised by joy, we find our hurt and our joy sit together as old friends. We find a larger world, a world that shuts nothing out, but rather encompasses it all. Excluding nothing, denying nothing. So this joy, it's not about distracting ourselves in the midst of whatever sadness we have, momentarily. Not that there's anything wrong with that for a while, but there's not that kind of joy of, right, like despite the sadness, we've managed to find ourselves a little moment of joy. It's really somehow at certain times when just both are able to exist without being in conflict with one another. I think of, probably goes on all the time, but especially very recently. There's a lot of turmoil in our world and a lot of turmoil in people's lives. From the point of view of practice, this can be seen as a certain kind of opportunity. I talk a lot about our mental map of reality, which periodically, for various reasons, proves inadequate or wears thin or even tears, right? And it's, we, it's difficult to prepare for that, right? You make your mental map based on here's my life and here's what I do and here's what my world looks like, and sometimes it's turned upside down, and we realize like this little map we've been carrying around is not like as reliable or true as we thought. But our practice is not predicated on safety or world happiness or peace or justice, although we want all of those things and work toward them. In another conversation today, I was talking to somebody who said that her, I don't want to say, like she said, a lot of times the sense that the self is not as kind of solid and reliable as we think, but is kind of codependently arisen with everything. Sometimes that's kind of a liberating or comforting feeling. She's saying, lately, it has not felt like that. Lately, it's felt kind of like this self is disoriented and is at the, mercy of all of these forces, which are beyond our control. I'm just trying to find some kind of footing for, mental health and for appropriate response. And I had thought about this passage from The Perfection of Wisdom in 8,000 Lines, which I figured I would share and then we could talk a little. So, The Perfection of Wisdom, the Prajnaparamita Sutras. The Prajnaparamita is the wisdom of emptiness, of appreciating what emptiness means, that even I have no inherent independent self nature, no beings do, no things do. So in this sutra, which is celebrating this wisdom of the perfection of wisdom is being the insight into emptiness. Wise bodhisattvas coursing thus reflect on non-production, and yet, while doing so, engender in themselves the great compassion, which is, however, free from any notion of a being. Thereby they practice wisdom, the highest perfection. But when the notion of suffering and beings leads her to think, "Suffering I shall remove, the wheel of the world I shall work." Beings are then imagined, a self is imagined, the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection, is lacking. They wisely know that all lives are unproduced as they themselves are. They know that all that is no more exists than they or any beings. The unproduced and the produced are not distinguished. This is the practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. And this is these next three stanzas are, I think they're my favorite. So the question is, where does the Bodhisattva stand? He does not stand in form, perception, or in feeling, in will or consciousness, in any skandhas whatsoever. So these are our what make up a human being: form, sensation, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. In Dharma's true nature alone, he is standing. Then that is his practice of wisdom, the highest perfection. Change and no change, suffering and ease, the self and not self, the lovely and repulsive, just one suchness in this emptiness they are. And so she takes not her stand on the fruit which she won, which is threefold, that of an arhat, a single Buddha, and a Buddha fully enlightened. Never mind about that stuff. The leader himself, the Buddha himself, was not stationed in the realm which is free from conditions, nor in the things which are under conditions, but freely he wandered without a home. Just so, without a support or basis, a bodhisattva is standing. A position devoid of a basis has that position been called by the Buddha. So the Buddha himself was not stationed in the realm which is free from conditions, nor in the things which are under conditions. So our language would be absolute and relative, right? The independent dimension and the dependent dimension of reality. It's not that the enlightened one only operates in this, realm where everything is precious and all things are perfect and there is no time and space, whatever. And it's not that they operate only in the relative. Freely he wandered without a home. Just so, without a support or basis, a bodhisattva is standing, a position devoid of a basis. This is what, whenever we're trying to make a decision, to feel confident, whatever, like we look for our basis, right? We look for our position. How do we know we are right? How do we know this is what we should do? And yet, in a time of turmoil or in a time when our mental map has kind of been torn up and thrown out the window, and really, any time that we really want to authentically respond in the moment to what is before us, none of that, any of that reference to some kind of position just gets in the way. And yet, even though the bodhisattva is not like, it's a position devoid of a basis, The Bodhisattva is standing. The Bodhisattva is working to free all beings and is standing. How can that be? I mean, we know this. We know this from our own experience when those times when we are able to give an appropriate response. And usually it is like not when we're overthinking it, right? It's not when we have, you know, written out our position and this is why I'm right and this is what is good. And where does it come from, right? It's something much bigger than our small sense of a self. We stand, we do stand, and we act and we speak. But if we are operating with the perfection of wisdom, we're not, maybe you could say we're not attached to a position. You know, we might not be like oblivious to any positions, but to not be attached to positions. One of the ways that compassion is described is like an arm reaching back for a pillow in the night. That, you know, I don't know about you, but I spend a lot of time thinking about how I should best respond and how I might be able to help the world in that. And yet, like, none of the stuff that I think about up here really pans out in any kind of great benefit. But that, you know, looking where are we just reaching for that pillow in the night? So any questions or comments about this profound bit of Dharma?
Domio,
Yeah.
the story of Persephone is often told this time of year as we look to transition into another season. And it reminded me as you went over the first section from Ford, I thought, well, he's practical, factual, just like you. So, yeah, that's why it just makes sense, you know. Emily Dickinson said we are open to possibilities. I don't know. I don't think I've been taught to sit zazen with an agenda, other than, you know, my own. It's just practice, but I appreciate this because it reminds me the notion of both and in the season that's coming, it reminds me I had a dance teacher who was from Louisiana, and she'd say, y'all have that expression, hunker down. And that's what we do, in a way, when I know I don't have to have answers, just I can just be with it, without agenda. Thank you.
Thank you. Leah.
Clicking all the buttons. So I think this is, I'm not sure if this relates, but I'm feeling like it might, that when I'm sitting with my friend who is terminally ill and we don't know how long he has, and I'm sitting there trying to be the best, most compassionate friend I could be. And inspired by Zen, I sit and think, well, I'm just gonna be a bodhisattva right here next to this guy, you know. And I don't know, I feel like I'm always questioning, am I doing the right thing? You know, am I talking too much? Am I not talking enough? Are we talking about what he wants to talk about? You know. If he's crying, should I cry too? Or Like I'm always asking myself that. I know I should just listen. Anyway, it's a very difficult position to be in, but I look at it as a opportunity to practice and maybe emulate some of these aspects of compassion that are in this passage.
I mean, what is pointed to here is like really hard. It's like the pinnacle of practice, right? To it'd be really easy not to conceive of self, right? Suffering I shall remove if you just went off and hunkered down and lived in a cave. But if you are trying to engage, you are trying to live this practice, then like this is what happens. To allow that kind of appropriate response to flow, you know, sounds trite, but like we get ourselves out of the way. That's the practice, is to get ourselves out of the way. It's not necessarily so easy to get ourselves out of the way, right? Or we get ourselves out of the way for a moment, and then the self comes back wondering, you know, was that it? Was that the right thing to do? But we know it's possible, and maybe we can only do it for a moment at a time, right? Like, and the very fact that you're kind of trying to cultivate awareness of this, you know, it's like at least it's like what I was talking about when I first started practice, and I would try to go for a mindful walk and like just ruin my walk because I was constantly like, am I being mindful? I wasn't being mindful that I should be more mindful. But at least trying to orient ourselves toward that, you know, what, and constantly asking, what is it this situation requires? And trying to be as open to that as possible is like light years better than going in with a, you know, a fixed idea or a plan.
Thank you. It makes a lot of sense why this feels like climbing Mount Everest or walking into fire. It feels so difficult. So thank you for that.
It's like there's I mean, I don't know. Once again, I'm thinking about the middle way here, right? Like an extreme idea would be like, if we're totally, I don't know, if we're totally enlightened and we totally have the self out of the way, then we're just going to walk around like responding appropriately to everyone and making everyone feel wonderful, and we'll always do the right thing, which is like, that is just not the way the world works. Like even a totally enlightened Buddha, I don't know, never met one, but could walk into a room. How are they going to know what a person needs or wants? And maybe the next moment that person's going to want something else, right? But we can try to cultivate as much like stillness of mind, as little self kind of doubt and preoccupation as possible. We can try to, you know, shed those layers as much as possible so that we're more perceptive, more responsive, less reactive. Denny. Oh, you're still muted.
Thanks. One of the things that this reminded me of is the feeling of not knowing, and of sometimes when you're waiting for something to happen or a way to help someone or correct a situation, it's someone or something that you would never have imagined could have been the answer or could have changed the situation. And this myth with Demeter and Zeus sending Hermes, who is the trickster and oftentimes is the one that gets in trouble himself, ends up being the one who rescues, is it Persephone? And it all also made me think of the climate crisis right now, because when Persephone is out of sorts, the earth just dries up, all the bounty disappears, and it all comes back, and there's joy when this troublemaker comes and rescues her, and the situation is fixed all of a sudden. And I've been in situations like that where, you're in a really bind, a real bind, either trying to figure out some dilemma that you're right in the middle of, or it's happening with somebody else. And well, just like Leo was explaining, and I was thinking about a quarrel that was happening in our neighborhood a few months ago, and it was really making everybody uncomfortable, and people couldn't talk to each other much anymore. And it was the woman who happens to be my neighbor, who's just such a constant gossip, and just always finding the worst in everybody, and everybody just turns around and tries to avoid her. But she came in and gave us all a different perspective on what was going on, and everything's okay again. And it sometimes I think it just it that's how it felt to me, that to just be open to whatever comes, and to be compassionate in the meantime, you just never know.
Thank you. Well, in chapter 22, kind of, I don't know, I felt like it's quite a was like a pleasant stream of consciousness kind of chapter, I think. I didn't really follow the point, but it was very lovely. Accepting that there's a flow to our lives and cycles and stuff like that. But I thought I would read this one section on page 186 and reflect. The name of the chapter is Seeing the Cycles, Letting Things Be. The deep connections of which our tradition sings. The perspective that we are all woven together so fine that we can't even find our separateness. This is an important encounter. I would even call it the God beyond God, the God that is a koan, an assertion of some great mystery together with an invitation. Again, words reach, but always, at least in these matters of our hearts, words fail. Collapsing into something more than that black hole. Yet, for those of us who've noticed this experience, we might recognize that description of autumn dew falling on a lotus that comes from a koan that he shared earlier in the chapter. where the a monk, the master Changsha says, "So where have you been?" Or no, somebody asked Changsha, "But so where have you been?" Changsha replied, "I've been strolling about in the hills." "Which way did you go?" "I went out following the scented grasses and came back chasing the falling flowers." The director smiled. "That's exactly the feeling of spring." Changsha agreed, adding, "It's better than autumn dew falling on lotuses." So, of course, referring to that. Yet for those of us who've noticed this experience, we might recognize that description of autumn dew falling on a lotus, which is, you know, that something beautiful, but it's also something that is wrapping to a close. It is important to notice this big thing, however we name it. It ties us together and puts the lie of our separateness and our sense of isolation to rest. But Changsha adds in something. We find that vastness nowhere but in things. And not things in general, but specific things. The person sitting next to you reveals the whole. Your own experience of this moment manifests the universe itself and the space beyond naming. The whole interdependent web is revealed in a single flower. Even when the ride on the ox is at its very smoothest, you can still feel the most particular undulations of its body navigating the path. The cycles all join together, like garlands of flowers, our individual lives, like the gift of a flower, fragile, beautiful, the dying already in the living, and letting things be. No cause, no effect, just this. And mysteriously, but truly, fully enough. I don't know. Does anything needed to be added to that? Pretty straightforward, I think. Comments or questions? Oh, we only have 2 minutes, so we could just end with that. Denny, do you have a comment or question? Oh, sorry, Denny, you were unmuted, so I thought you might have something to say, but that's fine. Here we are. I will wrap it up. We dedicate the merit of this Sangha meeting to all, so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Thank you.
So that's the ancient era. The ancient era. Is that what it's sorry?
By what?
By that description that you just read. The spring and the flower of Somia.
I don't know.
Do you think Bob fell asleep?
Oh. Wish we could do something. We can have it.
We could be noisy. We could ring a bell.
We could start like I just noticed that when you said that. Put a weird picture up on us. Bob has had enough for today.